Coming to you across the ether at the speed of light, it's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells and Kerry Deese of Preferred Financial. Join us for the next hour. We're going to take a look at how home buyers should beware. Well, Kerry, there's a very complex number of things that have to happen for someone to buy a home, and there are a lot of things that can go wrong along the way.
Oh, yes.
So we're going to go back to that old saying, caveat emptor, buyer beware. And we're going to look at some things to be aware of so you don't get caught in a bad buying situation. These are things that you can lay in stock before you even begin the process of walking out the door to look at a house, things that will prevent those headaches and the need for aspirin later on. So let's talk about some things that buyers should be aware of. I think this seems to always make the number one on any list that we do, and that is credit awareness or credit bewareness is something that a potential home buyer really needs to pay attention to. I'm going to mention something that over the course of 15 years or so of seeing these companies, we have found that they are able to do very little to actually help a borrower, and that is credit repair companies. So we're going to tell potential buyers out there, potential mortgage, whether you're refinancing or buying a home, entering into a mortgage transaction, you should talk to us before you talk to a credit repair company. First of all, many of the ones that you see on the internet simply do not accomplish anything. There's a method by which most of these companies work, and that is they dispute accounts in your credit report that have derogatory reporting on them. Now, if the derogatory reporting was not accurate, then that can be a legitimate thing to do. But, Kerry, tell our listeners, when a credit repair company disputes an account, why does it have the appearance of helping the borrower?
Well, what it does is it artificially removes the account from your scoring profile. So if you had, a collection account, it kind of makes it invisible to the score. It's like it never happened. So when that dispute comes off, your score is bad again unless it was removed.
That's right. And once an account is disputed, how many days does the creditor have to respond?
30 days.
Okay. So what happens is you engage a credit repair company. They go in and dispute all of your accounts that have derogatories, and all of a sudden your scores jump up. And they jump up because, as Kerry has explained, they simply, the credit laws require that while an account is in a disputed status, the account must be removed from the FICO scoring system. So you pay them some money, they run all these disputes, your credit scores shoot up, and you think, wow, this is really great. But the problem is this. The creditor will respond within the 30 days and will respond with an answer. And if the account really was delinquent or really was a charge off, then at the end of that, the account is returned to its collection status in the score system and your scores drop back again. So one of the tricks these companies have is they say, well, keep us on a monthly retainer and we'll keep your credit scores high. Well, again, all we find that they do is they continue to register disputes on the same accounts over and over and over again. But Kerry, what happens when we take a borrower ready to buy a house and we pull up their credit report and the scores look great, but there is one or more disputed accounts on that credit bureau?
You know, the mortgage companies are not very naive when it comes to that.
They're fully aware of those techniques.
Oh, yes. So disputes have to be completely removed. And that's not usually a quick process.
That's right. So you cannot apply for any mortgage, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, VA, USDA, you name them, with a disputed account in the credit system because that has artificially altered your credit score. Now, the reason that the law lets and requires that the account be removed from your score is that it gives the consumer the benefit of the doubt temporarily while the dispute is being resolved. But the problem is you cannot enter into a mortgage transaction with a disputed account, and you have to get them removed anyway. Well, that's when the scores are going to drop back down, and then you have acted under an artificial number thinking that you're okay to proceed, and then all of a sudden your score won't let you get an approval any longer. So we do not recommend credit repair companies other than to address legitimate accounts in which there is erroneous information. And that happens too, folks. So whenever an account is entered in the credit system, it's entered through the Social Security number associated with that account. Someone is typing that account in. If they miss the last digit and hit a 2 instead of a 1, all of a sudden a collection account appears in your credit bureau and it doesn't belong to you. That is a time in which a credit repair company might do you some good. They can demand proof, signatory proof, that that account was or was not yours. That must be provided within 30 days. If the creditor cannot come up with that signature and show and prove that it's you, then the account can be scrubbed and removed, and that indeed can help you. But for the way in which we see most credit repair companies work, you do not want to enter into a contract with them to pay them a monthly fee, because they're only going to be keeping your scores artificially elevated because they repeat the disputing process in an endless circle of disputes, and they'll keep you on the hook. We've seen people who have been using these companies for up to 2 years, and they come to buy a house, and again, we're the providers of the disappointing advice that, hey, we've got to undispute everything now and see where we really are.
And not only are you out the cost of what you've been paying these credit repair companies monthly, if you've had them on retainer, had someone the other day that was paying $100 a month to get these undisputed quickly, our credit bureau can do it, but it's $35 per bureau per account, plus the cost to repull the report. So if you've got a dispute on one account on all three bureaus, that's $35 times three. So it's not cheap.
It's not inexpensive. There's another thing that we get a question about all the time in regard to a legitimate collection account, and that is, should it be paid off before you apply for a mortgage? The answer to that is actually fairly complex. If there is a legitimate collection, and the collection account is of a dollar amount that is substantial, it can, in certain circumstances, prevent you from closing on a mortgage loan. But that's actually relatively rare. So as a rule of thumb, Kerry, what we found in dealing with collection accounts is if the account has been registered in the credit system within the last 12 months, it may benefit the borrower to pay it off. But as the collection account ages, the effect on the credit score diminishes. And so when we get around to collection accounts that are more than 3 years old, it's really rare that we want to or need to pay them off. Now, there can be exceptions to that. When we get automated underwritings from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they will tell us if those have to be paid off or not. FHA has a blanket requirement that basically says if the aggregate total of non-medical collections exceed $2,000, they either have to be settled in full, you have to enter into a repayment agreement and have to have been under that repayment agreement for, is it 6 months, Kerry, or 6 months before you can apply for a mortgage, or we have to assign an artificial payment of 5% of the balance, and if you can carry that in your debt ratios, we don't have to count it. When it comes to collection accounts, talk to us before you enter into any agreement or before you look to formally settle those accounts. It may or may not be necessary. The other thing is that there is a 7-year statute of limitations on all collection accounts. They simply fall off and are uncollectible after 7 years. So sometimes we just let the sleeping dogs lie, get you through your loan, and just let those extinguish themselves. When we get back off the break, we're going to talk about other things for buyers to beware of. Terry, would you tell people how they can contact us about any of the things we're talking about this morning?
Give us a call Monday through Friday at 864-235-9596 or email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com.
We're happy to field any questions, help you with any credit issues, take a look at where you are, look at your collection accounts, all the things we just talked about. We can help you get prepared to buy a home. Now, Carrie, there is this great home buying killer that lurks in the darkness.
Oh, yes.
And it jumps out and it bites people. And it bit one of mine customers that I had pre-qualified 9 months ago. And they came back, they're ready to buy a house. And lo and behold, the monster bit them. What's the monster?
They bought a car.
They bought a car. Now, look, I don't want to discourage you from owning a car. You need one. You got to have it. But don't kill your home buying process by buying a car in the middle of trying to buy a house. Here's what happens over and over again. Number one, the new car payment may be too high. And so you've killed your debt ratios. You can't afford the house that you could have afforded 6 months ago. And you could have made it all work out by maybe stretching the financing out a little longer, maybe a little lower payment. But you didn't call us until after everything was set up. And now we're telling you, you know that $250,000 house you wanted, you're going to have to cut your sights down to about $200,000 because of a car payment. The other thing that happens with a car payment, unfortunately, and again, the dealers aren't out to get you by any means. They want to get you the best financing they can on the car. But sometimes to do that, they will send your application out to multiple, and I mean multiple, car financing sources. And guess what? Every time they send it to one, they pull a credit report. So I had, and this sounds crazy, but I had a guy in last summer who we pulled up his credit report. He had 18 different credit inquiries from the same dealership trying to get him financing for his car.
That's not an exaggeration, folks.
It's a disaster because the number of inquiries affects your credit score. It had tanked his credit score. He had gone from a 680 to a 610. And that's just all the difference in the world. That's like the difference in conventional financing. And even it makes FHA marginal. So do not go buy a car. And I say this and also say unless you really have to. There are going to be some circumstances sometimes that overtake all of us. Your engine blows up. You know, your car gets wrecked. You got to go buy another car. That's happened before. We've had a wrecked car in the middle of everything. And, you know, you have insurance and all that, but you had a loan on the old car, so the insurance is going to pay your equity out. You got to get a new car, so you need a new car loan. So I want to tell you, yes, it's okay, but there's some things you really want to do. Number one, arrange your automobile financing before you step foot on a car lot. Or if you are going to get your financing through the dealer, take your own credit report with you. We'll give you a copy. And when you go, insist that they not pull your credit, but use your FICO scores to quote your interest rate that you can get. Then they will have to do at least one credit pull once you've isolated the lender that the dealer is going to use for your car. But do not go out and go blindly car shopping at five different dealers. Give them your information. You'll be hit with multiple inquiries. It can kill your loan. And you need to check with us by arranging financing up front so that we know what your payment's going to be so we can put that future payment in your debt ratios so you still qualify for your loan. Carrie, if we were going to use a rule of thumb as to, because this involves not only car buying, but we want to say all credit activity. You just don't want to do any new credit activity when you're in the process of preparing to buy a house.
And if you have to, just talk to us first.
At least give us a call.
Yep.
We can save you so many headaches because we can see ahead of time what the impact's going to have. And the impact may be manageable. But you don't want to find your dream house, put the contract in, only to find out that you don't qualify all of a sudden because of credit activity. So one rule of thumb is do not initiate any new credit activity 60 days prior to applying for a home loan. You just don't want to deal with that. Sometimes accounts are open. They don't get in the credit system. Then we have to pay to get them in the credit system. so that we can verify payments and stuff. Just rule of thumb, don't initiate any new credit activity of any kind when you're in the process of buying a home. Now, Carrie, there's one item that sometimes catches people, and that is they go into the store, and the furniture store or whatever store they're going into says, hey, open an account with us, and we'll give you a discount. And you know what? Whatever you charge on here, you don't have to make a payment for at least 2 years. What have they just done?
Well, we still have to count that payment,
even though they don't have to make one.
So.
Okay. So you're going to shoot yourself in the foot again. 90 days, same as cash. Discount for opening an account. No payment for 2 years. All of that still involves a credit activity, mm-hmm. a credit inquiry, and it establishes an account, and we have to assign a payment to that account, even if you're not having to make a payment, because someday down the road, you got to make a payment, and your home lender is not going to let you qualify without that payment in mind.
And on that same vein, you know, you go to a department store, and they say, sign up for a credit card today, you'll save 15%. Well, that might seem great now, but if you do that at every department store you go to save that 15%, it's really not worth it in the long run.
No, and two things happen. You may have too many inquiries in too short a period of time, but you may have too many open revolving accounts, mm-hmm. and that can hurt your scores too. Again, we're going to transition now to not so much buyer beware, but buyer do this, get pre-qualified. Once we pre-qualify you, we have a baseline credit report. From there, we can tell you what credit activity you could do if you had to, what credit activity you must not do between now and when you buy. Once we begin your pre-qualifying process, because it involves a credit report, we can chart you through those waters. But just don't willy-nilly, if you're thinking of buying a house in the next year, One of the things you're going to do is restrict your credit activity to only the necessary things, and we can help you determine what may or may not be necessary. Carrie, when we pre-qualify someone, what are we doing in that process?
We get the monthly income amount, how much you currently have in assets. We pull your credit. And we run the automated underwriting to make sure that you have a really good chance of getting approved.
And what are the automatic underwriting programs? What are they there for?
They're there to show the lender that they will already have the agency-backed approval.
Okay. All of the agencies, and by agencies we mean Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, VA, each agency has its own underwriting system, automated underwriting system. And although to have an automated approval is not an automatic loan approval, it's puts you where we consider you 95%, everything's going to go fine. As long as the information we used to obtain the approval is accurate, you told us you make $50,000. If you really make $50,000, then you have a high likelihood that your loan will be approved in underwriting. It's as close as we can get to a full loan approval, short of actually having an underwriter do it. Now, as you're getting pre-qualified, we can screen you for the various programs. And those programs differ in things like down payment. So you may need to begin to accumulate more down payment if you want to use, say, a conventional program versus an FHA program. And then each program has its own set of closing costs. Those need to either be accounted for in your savings if you're going to pay them, or it needs to be considered in your negotiating if you're going to have the seller pay for them. But we can tie those down to very tight numbers, so you know exactly how much money you have to come up with for down payment and for your closing costs, or to put into your contract what the seller needs to pay in closing costs. And then I always say that you need to make sure that your house fits your personal budget. We will be able to tell you how much house you can buy. That may not be as much house as you should buy, because everybody's personal budget is different. Our family sizes are different. Our children are at different stages. I wish I could tell you, and I've raised six kids, I wish I could tell you that kids get cheaper as they get older, but they don't. You may think that you're paying out a fortune in diapers, but believe me, the diapers are cheaper and the things that you'll encounter when they're teenagers, especially when they start growing and have to have a new set of clothes about every 2 or 3 months. And they outgrow their shoes, and, you know, they go from a size 6 shoe to a 13 and a half. That gets expensive. So how much you budget for your house doesn't need to always be determined by how much you can do, but by how much you feel like you can take on for to meet your personal budget. Now, Carrie, once you've been pre-qualified, once you know the programs that you're eligible for, then it's a good time to begin to be aware of what interest rates are and what payments are. And so many people turn at that point to Google and an online search to find out, hey, where are interest rates?
Mm-hmm.
But if we have to raise a big red flag, again, a buyer beware, I would say that one of the things we our buyers need to beware of are online mortgage quotes. First of all, you may go to a website that just has a generic today's 30-year fixed rate is, or today's 15-year fixed rate is, and then if you happen to look down under the very fine print, you'll find out the conditions under which those rates were quoted. I don't want to go so far as to say it's a bait and switch, but the question, what is the 30-year fixed rate today? That used to be a simple answer. Before the crash, it didn't matter whether you had a 620 score or a 720 or an 820 score. If you qualified for the loan, rate was the same. But that's just not the case anymore today. Interest rates can vary across a dramatic host of different conditions and events. Carrie, what are some of the things that can affect the interest rate that you'll receive?
Your credit score.
That's the biggest.
Your loan amount.
Loan size.
Loan size.
Mm-hmm.
Loan to value ratio.
Yeah, how much down payment is involved?
The property type.
Whether you got a condo, a house, townhouse.
The loan program.
The loan program itself. So just simply to go online and tag an interest rate may not be accurate as to the interest rate that you will receive. When we get back off the break, we'll talk a little bit more about bewareing mortgage quotes online.
And we're gonna make sure that word goes in the dictionary, bewareing.
Bewareing, yes.
And we're back talking today about what the buyer should beware of.
Bewareing, we call it.
Bewareing, yes. As always, if you have questions, call us at 864-235-9596. Email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. And if you want to hear our past shows, check out our website at www.preferredfinancialgreenville.com.
Thanks, Carrie. We were talking about the process of getting quotes on your mortgage rates. One thing that our buyers need to realize is that interest rates actually change every day. So you might want to do a little bit of rate hunting somewhere early in the process just to put you in the ballpark of where your payment might be. But then also realize that rates change every day. So when it gets down to, okay, I've got a contract, I'm ready to go, what will my rate be? If you're going to do some serious interest rate shopping, there's some things certainly to be aware of and to beware of. Number one, I would say don't take a verbal quote on an interest rate because it really has no meaning. What you need as a follow-up, if you get a verbal quote, is you need whoever's quoting you that rate to send you a fee sheet. Now, a fee sheet outlines all of the closing costs that you're going to encounter on the loan. And it's very important because, for instance, if you're going to compare rates from one company to the next, you want to make sure everybody is quoting apples to apples. There are payments called discount points that you can buy the rate down on your loan, and every lender can offer that buy down. But, for instance, someone may quote you a 4% rate, no discount points, and someone may quote you a 3.5% rate with 3 discount points, and you don't really have apples to apples here. The 3.5 looks good, but you've got to decide well, is it worth paying the extra money to get that rate? We'll talk about how to assess that at some point in our shows, but for the time being, just it's best when you're doing your initial quoting to put everyone on the same apples-to-apples basis. Normally, I would say in our area, that involves a quote with a 1% origination fee, no discount points. What's your rate? But to know that rate and for it to be accurate, the person quoting it must know all the things we mentioned before the break. Have to know your credit scores. Have to know the amount of down payment. Have to know the property type. You have to know the type of the transaction, whether it's a refinance, a purchase, a cash out refinance. All of those things can affect your rate, and you need to make sure the person on the other end understands all of those parameters, or your rate quote is really useless. Always follow up and receive a written quote with a detailed fee sheet. Now, a fee sheet should itemize every closing cost that you will encounter in the transaction. That should include any origination charges, underwriting fees, appraisal, attorney fees, title insurance fees, escrow deposits. It should cover everything, and it will give you the ability to do a side-by-side comparison with the different lenders that you might get quotes from. A fee sheet is not a formal document, though, Carrie. A fee sheet is kind of a preliminary document. So when a buyer is ready to go, has decided what lender he's going to go with, what is the formal document that tells the borrower and conveys to them exactly what they are getting?
That is called a loan estimate, formerly known as the good faith estimate.
That's right. We used to call it a GFE, a good faith estimate. Now it's called an LE, a loan estimate. And what you want to do with your loan estimate is make sure that it matches the fee sheet that you were given when your rate was quoted, to make sure they haven't slipped in any discount points, any associated fees that might not have shown up on your fee sheet. Ultimately, the LE is going to become a CD. And Carrie, what is a CD?
The CD is the closing disclosure.
So one program, we're going to do nothing but, what are they called?
Acronyms.
We're going to do an acronym program. We'll talk about the FSLECD. And then you'll know exactly, you'll be brilliant in the mortgage once you learn all the acronyms that there are. So the final CD is your closing disclosure. You won't get that until you're 3 days before your closing. However, the CD must line up with the LE, and the LE should line up with the fee sheet that you got when you got your quote. We always keep these in the file for the borrower. We always reconcile them when we get to the closing stage and say, okay, here are the charges we originally estimated on the fee sheet when we did our LE. Here were the charges. Now, here's the CD. Fortunately, Carrie, the law requires that certain fees cannot be changed once they're disclosed. What are the fees, though, that can be variable from the original fee sheet to the CD?
The attorney fees and title fees.
And they can vary only if you select your own attorney. If the lender has provided you with a list of attorneys and you choose off that list, then even those cannot be changed.
Well, they can change by about 10%, but there's just a little bit of a wiggle room.
Right. And then what else can vary?
The property taxes, the escrow amounts, depending on how much you obtain your insurance for, that type of information.
Correct. So in the beginning, if you're estimating a $250,000 purchase, the lender does not really know what the property taxes are on that house, and they can't really be aware of what the insurance is going to be. Now, their estimates should be pretty accurate, but they can't be precise. So these things can change. But the fees on the loan cannot change by law. And so you have some protections from the fee sheet all the way through the CD. Just be aware that there are some final items that you'll see on the CD that may be slightly different from your original estimates. And that's okay, as long as they're close and as long as they have explanations. Carrie, I would say that my number one warning to everyone who receives a loan quote and a fee sheet and initiates the loan, the one piece of advice I would give them is lock your rate in.
Absolutely.
Do not, and I want to repeat, do not let your lender float your lock or float your rate, because we got used to, from 2007 through about 6 or 8 months ago, we got used to interest rates being either declining, or we got used to them at least being the same over long stretches of time, because the Federal Reserve was intervening artificially to keep rates steady and even to drive rates down. We are not there anymore. We are in a generally rising rate market. When it's not rising, it is highly volatile. And you do not want to be counting on a $1,200 house payment. You didn't lock your rate, and all of a sudden you're looking at a $1,300 house payment because of the failure to lock your rate in. Every lender is capable of locking the rate in. Many lenders will play the rate game, but don't get sucked into that. You do not want any surprises. Now, I will say, Kerry, that as a broker with multiple lenders, we have some of our lenders who will let you lock, and if the rates improve enough, they will let you drop your rate down before you close.
Sure.
That's not every lender, and certainly you should ask your lender if they have that feature. But if they do not, or if they do, lock your rate in. Buyer beware. Don't start out thinking you're going to have a low house payment only to be disappointed that you're going to pay another $50 or $100 for the 30-year life of that loan. You don't want that to happen. Beyond getting your fee sheet, getting reasonable quotes from different sources that are on an apples-to-apples basis, locking the rate in when you're ready to proceed. The next thing we want you to do in terms of home preparation, so that you are aware of the other hurdles that can arise, is you want to engage your professionals. We talked about this last week, but you're going to want a buyer's agent. A real estate transaction is actually a very complex transaction. Years and years ago, back 1980, I took a real estate course to get a real estate license. And what I learned in that class has served me all of these years, but it is incredible to me the amount of legal terms, the amount of legal technicalities that go into a real estate purchase. You are purchasing a tangible asset, one that you must be able to prove ownership of and hold title to in a manner that preserves your interest in that property for as long as you own it, and preserves that through the sale of that property when you let go of it. And because of that, I just do not recommend for most people to chart their way through a real estate transaction on their own. If you have been in and around real estate and you are familiar enough, it certainly is something that can be done. But for most of us out there, what you think you may be paying to have a buyer's agent on hand is just nominal compared to what they can save you. And as Kerry mentioned last week, in the process of buying a home, if you engage a buyer's agent, for any house that is listed with any other realtor, the seller is going to pay your buyer's agent in the bottom line when you get to closing. So you get to use an agent who represents you, who can negotiate for you, who can make sure that you don't fall into any pitfalls, that can tell you what's important and what's not. And their information that they can provide to you is so much more valuable than trying to go it alone, wing it alone, thinking you might save some 2 to 3% on a transaction. We're going to talk about engaging your other professionals, some things with your professionals to do, as we wind it up on the last segment. Coffee, and we'll finish up our buyer bewareness, or we will be here bewaring, I suppose, right? We've been talking about all the things that you need to be aware of if you're going to enter into the home buying process. One of the things before the break we talked about was engaging your professional. The very first thing you want is to engage a realtor on your behalf to represent your interests in the transaction, a buyer's agent, who can help you with your negotiations and help you chart your way through the process. Most realtors use a standard state-approved real estate contract, but you do need to be aware that there should be some parts of that contract that we call contingencies. Now, contingencies are basically agreements that say, okay, I will buy this house as long as, or I will buy this house if, or I will not buy this house unless. So contingencies are maybe sometimes called escape clauses, but they can be very critical to protecting your interest in the transaction. Carrie, talk to our listeners out there about what types of contingencies you would want to have in your contract.
To make sure that the house actually appraises for the purchase price.
That's an appraisal contingency. You have agreed to pay $225,000 for the house, contingent upon an appraisal supporting the value. That means if it doesn't come in, the appraisal doesn't come in at the value you agreed on, you can cancel the contract and get your earnest money back. What other contingencies might be out there?
There may be some repairs that need to be done.
Okay, a repair contingency that might be coupled with a home inspection contingency. Mm-hmm. I will agree to buy this house as long as I can have a home inspection done and as long as that home inspection doesn't say that certain repairs need to be done. So a repair contingency is critical. A financing contingency is critical. Even if you've been pre-approved, even if you have gone through the automated underwriting system, because there are always is that one chance in 100 that something didn't line up. All of a sudden, your salary is changed at work, or you have to go through a job change at the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
There are many reasons that your loan might get turned down from things that are not necessarily within your control, but that prevent you from getting your financing at the last minute. And you don't want to lose your earnest money. You want a contingency, a financing contingency in the contract. Now, contingencies allow you to get your earnest money back. But, Carrie, we have seen some transactions and some contracts in which earnest money will not be refunded. So if you're going to enter into one of these transactions, beware. What would those be?
If you're purchasing at a foreclosure auction or you're purchasing a HUD home.
Yes. Under those circumstances, because you are bidding on property, effectively, HUD homes, even if HUD is selling them direct, they will receipt in any number of bids, and then they will award the winner. But when they award that, you are under obligation to complete the transaction. And if you do not, for any reason, HUD keeps your money. If you go to a foreclosure auction and you are the winning bidder, you have to post a earnest money with that bid, and you lose that if you do not finish the contract.
And a lot of times those earnest money requirements are a lot higher than those on a normal contract.
That is correct, especially your foreclosure auctions if you get into that. Even regular bid auctions, like there can be real estate auctions, generally they have the same requirement, the posting of earnest money that can be non-refundable. So you have to look at the terms under which the auction is being done in order to know it, and don't fall into a trap where you might lose your earnest money or you're not prepared to lose it. It's okay to go to these bids. It's okay. But, you know, you probably don't want to use your life savings in a situation where you cannot get your earnest money back, because if that home falls through for you, you certainly want to go and buy another one. There's another, class of transaction that can really throw a monkey wrench at everything. Now, your realtor can keep this from happening because they would be aware of this. But if the home that you are buying is potentially going to generate a short sale, then there are a lot of considerations before you enter into a contract. What's a short sale, Carrie?
It's where the lender accepts a payoff of less than what they are owed.
Okay, now we're talking about the seller now.
Right.
That the seller is selling you the house at a price that is less than what they owe the lender. We haven't seen too many of these, fortunately, in the last few years, but after the crash, we saw a lot of these. What's the problem with a short sale, Carrie, and why do our buyers need to beware of a short sale?
It's really just the time that it takes for the seller to get that approved with their lender to accept the amount that they're going to pay.
That's right. So once you have a contract, the lender can calculate how much they're not going to get paid. They have to agree to cancel the seller's mortgage so that you inherit a house in the sale that has no lien on it. And that process, we have literally seen it take 6 to 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
6 to 8 months, okay? Not days, not weeks. I don't know why. I don't know why it takes them that long to make a decision. But if you are going to enter into a contract on a house that is going to generate a short sale, you better count on an extended amount of time before you'll be able to move into that house. And sometimes we get to the end of the 6 months and they just say no.
Right.
And sometimes they don't give you a renegotiated price and say, okay, if you will offer this much, then we will do the short sale. It's just, I don't understand it. I'm not sure why lenders take that long and are not more definite about what they will or will not take. But you can pick up a good value in a short sale from time to time, but it may be at the cost of 6 to 8 months of waiting time, and it may be 6 to 8 months only to find out it isn't going to go through.
Right.
So probably avoid short sales unless you're an investor and you got the time to wait. You probably don't want to do that with your primary residence. We had talked last week, we're going to talk again about part of the professionals you need to get a home inspection. As far as buyers, beware and be wearing of things. Number one, you want to watch out for homes that have been flipped that have a lot of cosmetic work that have been done, but where structural issues and foundational issues have not been addressed. We always recommend a home inspection if you're buying a home that is not brand new, that comes with a warranty. Spend $300 on a home inspection because they can make sure that what was done to a home that's being flipped was done properly according to code and doesn't leave you with items that look good for a while but aren't going to last and hold up over the long haul. If you are buying a home that has been dramatically renovated, it's a good idea to request from your seller the names of the contractors and subcontractors involved. Some of their work probably is guaranteed, but that all may fall through the cracks if you don't know who they are. And if, for instance, a brand new hot water heater was installed and you move into the house and 2 weeks later your hot water heater quits working, you're going to want to know who put this thing in, where was it bought, and where do I get my warranty information. So if you're buying a home that has been upgraded, make sure that you get a documented list from the seller of the contractors and subcontractors who were involved so that you've got a handle on getting any repairs done that might fall under any warranty agreements for equipment and appliances. Also, you may want to check with public record to make sure that permits were taken out to do the improvements that were done to the house. That will ensure that everything was done according to code. As we mentioned last week, you definitely want a termite inspection. And while they're doing that, they'll inspect for any mold in the crawl space. I'll also check for powder post beetles. All of these things, if you're with any house you buy, but particularly one that has just been renovated, make sure that the renovations were all done properly, done to code. You have access to the contractors who did the work so that if you have any recalls or anything you need to do in the way of repairs, you have some options. And, Carrie, let's talk in the last few minutes about some other things to be aware of as a buyer of a house, and these don't necessarily have much to do with qualifying for a mortgage, but are certainly things that you should consider. One of those things is we recommend in buying a house that you don't exhaust your last penny in doing so. Emergencies can come up, difficult stretches can come up, layoffs can come up, job security is not what it was 25 years ago. Jobs are pretty interchangeable, but you have to plan that you might be out of work for a week or two or three or four. You might have a employer who has paid time off policies, but they change those. There are a lot of things that can intervene early after you have purchased a home that can really throw you. you've taken on this financial responsibility, and all of a sudden you've got an emergency that comes up. So we recommend to just be aware that there can be events in life that we don't and cannot plan for, but we can put back a little bit of safety net. We can put back what we call reserves. That's money left over after you buy the house, and that you don't exhaust all of your savings. There's some other things that you may want to plan for down the road. Your future needs. Maybe you didn't buy that car while you were house shopping, but you're going to need that car. So you want to plan for that. As you are acquiring the house, leave room to buy the car down the road. You may have student loan payments that are deferred right now, but one day you may have to make a payment on those. Make financial plans for those things. Also, Carrie, there are costs of owning a home. What type of cost for homeownership that you have that you don't have when you're a renter?
Repairs. That's a huge one.
Or replacing appliances.
Yeah.
Replacing a heat and air system. I recommend that homebuyers set up their own capital account. If you're going to replace a heat pump, it's going to cost you, what, $7,500. And that's a big chunk of money.
Mm-hmm.
However, that heat pump will last 10 or 15 years. So if you have a new heat pump in your house, why not put aside $34, $35 a month starting now? And that way, when the heat pump is ready to be replaced, you've got the money. Also, in the home buying process, it's a good time to look at insurance. And by that, I mean disability and life insurance to protect your family in the event that either you or your spouse is disabled or deceased, that your family can continue to live in your house. All these things, buyer beware. Call us and we'll help you in your bewaring process. 864-235-9596.